Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Caged In podcast, you bullshit artist.
And welcome to episode 15 of Coppola Connections, the podcast where I am shaking every branch of the Coppola family tree to find out, are they the greatest film family of all time? The way I intend to do that is by looking at every film in the collective family's filmography. And I'm joined by a guest each week. And this week I'm joined by the lovely Ella Kemp to look at Judd Apatow's 2009 comedy drama Funny People, which stars Adam Sandler, Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen, Leslie Mann, and Jason Schwartzman, making it this week's Coppola Connection. Unfortunately for this episode, there is no Patreon bonus content just because we recorded this on a super hot day and I was just sweating out, and I often get quite aware of like stealing people's time when recording, and sometimes I just chicken out and I don't ask the question, are you okay to do the Patreon questions? So that's why there isn't any Patreon bonus content for this episode. But if you'd still like to put some money in the bucket, you can do so over at patreon.com/cagedinpod. As is the case with every episode, we will be talking about this film in spoilerific detail. There is no stone left unturned. So if you would like to duck out now, do so, or check the show notes for a handy document that will tell you if and where this film is streaming. So all that's left to do is to fold away your fold-out sofa, write some jokes for a terminally ill comic, and make some Coppola connections. This week's film is Judd Apatow's 2009 comedy drama Funny People. Our Coppola connection is Jason Schwartzman, who both plays Mark Taylor Jackson and provides music for the film's score. To help me kickstart my career in comedy, help me punch up some of my jokes, and maybe become friends along the journey, is writer, editor, presenter, and photographer Ella Kemp. How are you, Ella?
Hello, I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Yeah, you've kind of got like a multi-hyphenate like things that you do. Where can people usually find you? Like, what are you usually doing in the world?
You can find me on Twitter a lot of the time. I am there at Ella_Kemp. And yeah, when I'm not on Twitter, I'm writing for NME and Empire and Letterboxd mainly, and then I'm also publishing and editing essays at The Quietus, Girls on Tops, and Massive Cinema. Those are my main places, but you know, whoever will have me, really.
Amazing. So yeah, as I always start these off, I always ask, how did you become aware of the Coppola family as this kind of entity that they are? Was there an entry point of a person and then you realized, holy shit, there's loads of them?
Good question. I mean, I think I'd made a lot of separate I discovered a lot of them in separate ways before realizing that they were all connected. And I don't even know if there was a light bulb moment. It was more, I realized it and was kind of a bit embarrassed that I hadn't realized earlier. So very much kept it to myself because I was like, oh yeah, I really should have known this. I think I watched The Godfather when I was maybe 15 or something, thinking, you know, I should watch this. But at the same time, I was a 15-year-old teenage girl. So I was like, oh my God, I actually want to watch every Sofia Coppola film. So those two things are kind of happening at the same time. And then, I don't know, they've just been everywhere since. And it's like, I suppose about maybe 70% of the time that I'm enjoying a film, I'm like, oh, there's a Coppola in this. Why we're here. It makes sense now.
When did you have the realization that, like, Jason Schwartzman was also related to him? Because I remember when I figured that out, it was a big like, holy shit.
I don't even know, like probably last year or something. I don't know. I think he's another one who I discovered separately, very much via Wes Anderson. I think that was my way in with Jason Schwartzman, and he was just one of those actors who kept popping up and I didn't know his name for ages. And I just thought, oh yeah, there's that guy that I like, and like haven't gone to the effort to Google for some reason. And he was just always there every time. So first of all, it was about discovering his name as his own person, which that probably happened about a year ago. And then realizing that he was part of this same family, maybe 6 months ago. I don't even know. Like, I'm shocked that we're here at all. I was annoyed more than anything when I discovered he was part of the family. I was like, really? Like, this as well? You're here as well?
When I figured out his mum is Talia Shire, who was Adrian in the Rocky films, like, I was just like, my mind melted. I was
And then, like, are we living in the world or in their world? You know?
Exactly. And then you, like, you hear this, like, the story of how he got Rushmore is like, oh, Sophia and like knew some people who knew like like Wes and stuff like that, a casting director, and he was at like a family party, and it's like, can there not be like a slice of nepotism that this family doesn't go,
but the thing is, I would be furious if he wasn't just so good
at everything
he does. Like, he's so annoyingly talented that whenever I would want to come out and say anything bitter, I just can't. I just kind of just have to nod and be like, yeah, you know what, fair play, really.
Well, yeah, even if you look at like kind of, I think I figured out he is, including Nicolas Cage, who is like a absolute workhorse. Jason Schwartzman seems to be the most productive member of that family. Like, his kind of credits, like with film and television, and then we factor in music and the kind of cultural touchstones that he's made. Like, it's like everyone always thinks like, Phantom Planet's California is an absolute banger. It made the OC, some would argue. He wrote that song.
Oh my God, did he?
Yeah. He was the original drummer for Phantom Planet.
Wow. Wow, that's wild. Yeah. Magic. What a great song.
Amazing. Well, as a journalist, have you ever had the opportunity to meet a Coppola at all?
I haven't, no. They always seem to be this very elusive. For good reason. I feel like if they did lots of press, it would kind of remove the mystique around them. I mean, they wouldn't be any less talented or terrifying or anything, but no, to my knowledge, there's only kind of a select few who have had the privilege, and I'm not one of them yet.
I always think, like, I was trying to get PR contacts and stuff like that, and I'm like, I'm always worried if I say, like, oh yeah, I do a podcast about their family, people immediately be like, red flag, this guy's like got walls plastered with their photos and stuff like that.
That makes you an expert, which is impressive more than anything, I think.
Thank you very much. So what would have been the first Jason Schwartzman film that you remember seeing?
Off the top of my head, it must have been Rushmore, I think. That would have been the first main one. Obviously, as we've said, he's done so many things and been in so many other things that it might have been like any Wes Anderson film.
I think it's him and like,
as in any other one.
Bill Murray are kind of like duking it out for who's been in the most.
Exactly. But probably Rushmore, I think, was the first big one. I think that was the one that finally made me Google his name. I was like, this has gone on for long enough. You know, I was like, now we've got to find out who this guy is. It's interesting because I feel like when you don't see him acting, like if you were just to see a picture of him, I would think, oh yeah, he is like, he looks like about 80% of all of male Hollywood, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I just must be just another one of those. But then when you see him acting, I was like, oh my God, like nobody else could do this. He is just magnetic in this really weird way.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in some way, like when talking about this film, that kind of, even when he's playing like a bit of a dick, he's still amazingly charming and like sweet. And it's like, I kind of still want to be his mate. Let's talk about funny people.
I like having a girlfriend. I don't have one, but I like it better. One night stands are tough, and I'm not great at sex, so at the end of every time, I gotta go, and normally I do better than that. Girlfriends are so much better. You finish up, and you're just like, well, you know. That's how I do it.
Hey, George Simmons, you destroyed, man.
You the guy who was on after me?
It's very hard to be romantic with women when you live on a pull-out couch. Once those two little legs come down, you know it's on, right?
You were good.
Maybe you can write me some jokes.
I've been going to this guy's movie since the moment I can remember. This is amazing, guys.
If he's like, do you have any friends that are like you but just way funnier, you can say yes.
I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want you to get all weird on me. I'm dying.
It's too early to know who's winning the fight, the medicine or the disease.
Did anybody ever tell you a very scary accent?
You are a very funny man. I enjoy your movies.
And I enjoy all of your movies.
Which movies?
The ones where you try to kill Bruce Willis.
Oh my God, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Are you crying right now?
I don't think I am.
Oh, yeah, come on, wipe it off. People are gonna think I broke up with you.
Did you tell your mom?
Yes, I sent her an email and she tried to email me back on a toaster. There is always the one girl out there that got away.
This is my husband, Clark.
The one that got away. Guys have that and serial killers have that. Hey, you want to talk to me while I try to fall asleep?
So you're right, that's not your real name. You're hiding some Judaism.
I don't think I can hide that. My face is circumcised.
So when did you see this film for the first time? What were your first impressions when you saw it, Ella?
I first saw this film at the start of 2020, I think. Mm-hmm. Because Judd Apatow was just about to release his new film, The King of Staten Island, which with Pete Davidson, which I was really looking forward to. And I'd seen some of Judd Apatow's comedies, but this felt like quite a big blind spot. Well, because it's a comedy, but as we know, it's so much bigger and more sincere and just so much more than all the others. I think it was maybe in the first lockdown, so last April or something, back when we had lots of time.
Yes.
Which worked well for this film because it's so long. I watched it then and I really, really loved it. I knew that quite a few close friends of mine who were critics really, really loved it. So yeah, like I was going in hoping to like it, really. And I really did. I'm a big fan of The Great Gatsby, so that helped. And I thought it was so solid. I rewatched it today. It's still great. Still so solid.
Which version did you watch? Because I know that, like you said, it's long, and then I realised there's like an extended cut as well, which is like,
oh God.
I think it's only like 10 minutes, but like even that, then it draws it to being like actually 2.5, like over 2.5 hours long. And it's like, I think it's only like they just, you know, like when they do, like back in the day, it was a big thing when they do like the dirtier cut on DVD, and it's like they just put back in all of the jokes that were on the cut.
I don't know. I mean, Maybe I watched that one. Like, the one I watched was definitely 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't pay attention both times, like, where I watched, because I think, I don't know, when I first watched it, it was on one streaming platform, then it wasn't. Anyway. When I watched it today, I did have, like, because I knew that it was going to take a while until, like, Leslie Mann came into things, which is just so bizarre to think about. But yeah, today I was really like, fucking hell, like they tell a lot of jokes, don't they? There's a hell of a lot of jokes before we get to her. I probably watched the one full of jokes.
What I find interesting about this film is, and I think it's kind of like the fact it came out in 2009, this very much to me feels like, if this was made now, this would be perfect for like a kind of a mini series, like even like the structure of it, because you kind of, there is like a definite, and I guess it's a criticism a lot of people have to Judd Apatow's work, is that it has this, it feels like two films. It gets to a point and like, it's like, oh no, here's another story we're going to tell. Like, yeah, this is kind of
completely,
when you get to like the Orpheum Theatre and Leslie Mann is kind of fully in the film, it's like, oh, this is a totally different film to the kind of like buddy comedy that we've got up until this. I always like to put people on the spot and ask them to give a synopsis of the film. Could you do that for us, please, Ella?
Oh my gosh. Yes, I can. I can remember the names of the characters, not the actors, which I've watched today.
Actors is fine.
Okay, Adam Sandler is a comedian who was very popular and is less now. Mm-hmm. He finds out that he's dying. He has a rare form of cancer. And so, like, we think at first that what he wants to do is find a way to be funny again. So he meets this, like, up-and-coming comedian and, like, starts writing with him, well, paying this guy to write with him and write jokes. The up-and-coming comedian is Seth Rogen. Is it Seth Rogen?
Yes.
It is. Yeah. I was like, oh, he's thrilled. It's this great buddy comedy. And then halfway through the film, people from Adam Sandler's past like come back into his life as he, you know, thinks he's fully properly dying. One of those people who comes back is Leslie Mann. I really should know these characters' names. I couldn't tell you.
I've got them. I'll
finish it. That's fine. You can edit it. One of these people is Leslie Mann, who was Adam Sandler's like one that got away, love of his life. She's now married, and like I actually can't tell you how this happens. That they go from her seeing him and just be like, okay, you know, we had something years ago. Yeah. I'm glad we've cleared the air. To then, like, Seth Rogen and Adam Sandler go and see her in her house. Things get rekindled between Adam Sandler and Leslie Mann. There's this whole, like, it's not a love triangle with Seth Rogen. He's just there. And then the husband's there. It's like a square. Stuff kind of happens from there. That was my very brief, very succinct, very good synopsis.
No, that was perfect. So, you kind of talked about the actors, and obviously, this is a pretty stacked film. Like, as you mentioned, we got Adam Sandler as George Simmons, Leslie Mann as Laura, Seth Rogen as Ira Wiener, but he goes by Wright because, no, Wiener, sorry. Wiener, not Wiener.
Wiener.
We have Aubrey Plaza as Daisy. Mm-hmm. Eric Banner as Clark, as I mentioned, Jason Schwartzman as Mark Taylor Jackson. Who else in there?
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill as Leo, who kind of like encapsulated Aziz Ansari, like, I'm trying to think of who else. And then, like,
Bo Burnham,
Paul Reiser. We've kind of
my
like,
guy.
We've got like a whole just like, and I guess like there's a thing for people who are like real comedy nerds. So I know like Judd Apatow is, and I know this is very much born out of a love of stand-up comedy. Because like when he was a kid, he would, what it would be now is like a podcaster basically like duped comedians into doing interviews for him just because he loved comedy so much. So like this very much feels like that. And it feels deeply personal as well. Like, because I know, like, the film opens with that, like, home footage of Adam Sandler doing prank calls and stuff like that. So I probably should ask, are you an Adam Sandler fan? Because I guess, like, that kind of, I don't know, this film slightly hangs on that slightly, or an interest in him at least.
I honestly don't think I am, you know, like I don't actively dislike him. But him being in a film won't make me see it. Like that won't be the hook for me going to see it. So I think I kind of went into this thinking, like, I'm ready to be convinced, like, you, good luck, Adam, you have to make me like this film. And he did. I think he's, yeah.
I think what this film does really well is it manages to play with people's perception of Adam Sandler. Because obviously we get these films within the films where it's, well, you look at them and you're like, they're not far off what Adam Sandler actually does. Like, and I know, like, looking through like the DVD extras, there's even more like outlandish things. And then, like, there's like a foreign exchange student film that he was in, and like the cast even goes more crazy. It's like stuff that was cut out of this film had like King John in it and stuff like that, and it's like from The Hangover and like but yeah, Adam Sandler's fascinating. I think some people, like, this very much gets thrown in that thing of, is Adam Sandler actually acting? Like, do you know what I mean? It's kind of, people go like, oh, it's Punch Drunk Love, Uncut Gems, and Weirdly Funny People are like the three ones.
Yeah.
It's like, he's actually putting in a performance. So yeah, what do you make of Adam Sandler's performance in this film?
I think he's really good. Yeah, I think he's solid. I think because he is playing a stand-up comedian who is trying to figure out how to tell jokes again. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the crux of his character, is him struggling.
Yeah.
And I think it's the struggle that makes his acting really interesting, because it means that he has to find something like more vulnerable and more sincere and more complicated than perhaps a lot of the comedy that he has been known for. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the comedy that he's been known for, and a lot of people love it, but just in terms of what I just personally enjoy, I find this kind of performance much more interesting to kind of just deconstruct, that whole comedy. And I find that interesting with all stand-up comedians, really, when they kind of really try and peel it back, which is why I like Bo Burnham so much. I think that kind of self-awareness and...
Yeah, because...
It's just very good, yeah.
Because he even does like some of his kind of tropes that are quite irritating, whether it's the like that voice when he goes like, and I speak a bit like this, and it's a bit like,
so annoying.
sorry to do it. But then, like, and it's interesting because he, like, George Simmons, like, we get that news like literally straight away in the film that he's got AML, and then it's like, he's wholly unlikable for like the first, I don't know, like third of this film. Do you know what I mean? And it, like, he kind of treats Ira, Seth Rogen's character, like a piece. He treats everyone around him like a piece of shit. And we kind of like, even when we get to that moment where he sits down with his sister, it's like, oh, like, he's been a piece of shit for a long time. Do you know what I mean? Like, early doors, we get kind of him told that, and we get Chekhov's girlfriend, like ex-girlfriend as well, when we get the phone call to Laura and she's like, oh, I'm kind of busy at the moment. It's like, well, it's Leslie Mann in a Judd Apatow film. She's going to have a big role. Let's talk about Jason Schwartzman in this. And I think, I want to play a clip that I think perfectly sums up his like introduction into the film and what we talked about earlier of him being like a bit of a dick as well.
I give you 10 days on your 3-month plan.
No, I need 80 more days than that.
Okay, I do this because I care about you. I do this to motivate you. But I will fuck that girl in 10 days, I promise.
Come on, dude, I'm not cute like you. I don't look like Jackson Brown. I look like Jon Favreau.
Don't do this to me. Don't make me fuck her.
Well, then just don't fuck her.
Don't you put me in this corner where I have to fuck my way out.
He'll do it, too. He'll do it. I've seen him do this before.
I'm going to go out there and warm her up. I'll see you out there.
So what do you make of Jason Schwartzman in Funny People, Ella?
Oh my God, he's such a piece of shit. I love him. It's so annoying. He's so good in this film. I find his character very interesting because I think he is one of the few people in this film who is actually at his core a piece of shit. Because I think that George Simmons seems that way at yes. first. And then, you know, you realize there's a lot more conflict and he's very lonely and sad and kind and good. And like Ira is amazing and like all their friends are very insecure. And then Jason Schwartzman is just there and he's just like, I have a role in a sitcom. I'm going to fuck this girl. And like, and he doesn't, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a, it's not a bit. That's like who he is. It takes a very...
His whole thing is like, even when he seems like he's caring, like when he calls Ira, like when he's at like Leslie Mann's house and stuff like that, it always seems to come back to him. Or even when he's like trying to give like a kind of like the ear to like for him to call on, he's like, yeah, but I've got these. Do you know what I mean? I've got these problems. I didn't get that role in that Tobey Maguire film, which I thought was a brilliant, like especially with Mark's character, because I know Tobey Maguire like famously said he had like this kind of gang of Hollywood actors called like the Pussy Pack or something like that. So it feels Jason Schwartzman is playing one of those kind of like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like I am going to abuse the fact that I am on screen to basically sleep my way around Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's just very, I don't know how he does it. Like he's so manipulative. but he does it in such a way that makes you think that makes you think that you're the one in the wrong and that he is nice and that you should be grateful that he is explaining to you the errors of your ways. In that way, he is the most relatable man in a film that I have ever seen. No, he's great. And I think, I don't know, it takes a very specific type of actor to do it so well that he can be, like, this script on paper, the lines that he has, they are undeniably, like, awful and cruel. Mm-hmm. And just, like, so, you know, like, horrible. And it takes a specific type of actor to play those lines extremely straight and, like, still convince you that they're really charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is that way as an actor, and he manages to maintain that even while properly inhabiting this despicable, like, little twerp, really. He's great. I love it. So good.
So obviously that thing that he, that 10-day rule that he gives Ira sets up, like, the kind of conflict between them two and introduces Aubrey Plaza's character. And I know Judd Apatow said in an interview that thing that Ira does when he spills the orange juice on the table is like wholesale lifted from like his real life. Like, and I think it kind of has a different reading when you like, basically Seth Rogen is a Judd Apatow avatar in this film. Like he kind of is this guy who wanted to get into comedy and stuff like that. And I guess, it's weird because Adam Sandler is at the focal point of this, but like, what do you think to the fact that like, it feels like it's almost Ira's story really of him trying to find his voice as an artist in some way. It just happens to be like a comedian.
Yeah. I mean, completely. I think that like, there's been a lot that's been made about how this film, I haven't read as to whether Judd Apatow has said this openly, but like, I'm pretty sure he must have done about like the parallels with The Great Gatsby and all that kind of thing. How basically like the dynamic between Ira, George and Laura like that George and Laura are very much, you know, Jay Gatsby and Daisy Buchanan, and you can see it in like George's enormous mansion, which is exactly like a Gatsby mansion, but this Gatsby is always told from the perspective of is his name Nick?
The other guy. Yeah,
I don't know. I'm pretty sure his name is Nick. Is it? Am I making up things called Nick Carraway? Oh, God, this is terrible. Anyway, the other guy, who, interestingly, in the live-action version, as in the remake.
Yeah.
Tobey Maguire. So, you know, it's all... I don't think that was a coincidence. I mean, that film that was made after...
This one.
Funny People. But yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so anyway, my point was that Gatsby is told from the perspective, I'm pretty sure it's Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Gatsby's told from Nick's perspective. And Jay Gatsby is very much this elusive figure who dips in and out of his story. And I think George obviously is much more present because we start with him rather than with Ira. But Funny People very much has what Gatsby has. I definitely feel closer to Ira in this throughout. I think once he is introduced, we kind of latch onto him and don't really leave, I don't think. Which works well because the film, you know, goes all over the place. But I think Ira is the one thing that remains and kind of guides you through it. I prefer that.
I think the backbone of this, and it kind of like, I don't know if it Trojan horses it, but like it definitely gets muddled in that middle section when you kind of you're with Leslie Mann and her family, that it's about that rekindling of relationship. But like, it Trojan horses it in the way that like by the end you realize the kind of the romantic story, as it were, the kind of like will they, won't they, is Ira and George. Like, it is this kind of like, will they become friends, or are they going to kind of break through the employer employee thing? And it's like, even the way that it's set up of why Ira is employed in the first place, it's not a fact of George actually needs someone to do all this stuff for him. It's like the fact that he's desperately lonely, and I think like that's what makes this an interesting film, is that it could have been like a gross out comedy, or do you know what I mean, like it kind of has its cake and eat it in that respect. Like they go, oh, they're comedians, so we'll have plenty of dick jokes. It's fine. But at the same time, we'll hit.
But they're only doing that on stage.
Yeah. So, how do you feel about like the actual like performances of comedy in this? Because I know that it can be any kind of live performance in film can be quite hard to nail, right?
I think, I don't know. I didn't really warm that much to the actual performances of comedy in this. Mm-hmm. I don't love Aziz Ansari at all.
Rightfully
so. Like watching that last year and this year, I was a bit like, every time I was like, okay, fine, I have to sit through this bit now. But I think because so many of these comedians are deliberately being shown as like, you know, trying stuff out and kind of trying to make it. And the script is written by people who have made it.
Yeah.
The rest of the script, when it's not on stage, is so much funnier than a lot of the sets that are being performed. And I'm sure that's deliberate in the point. So whenever like they were back on stage, I was a bit like, oh, okay, we're back here again. Here we are again.
I know that they tried as much to get the cast to like write their own material for like their comedy. And I think like the one person who really nails it and kind of encapsulates like, I would think like, oh no, that actually like they could be a comedian is Aubrey Plaza. I just think like her
she's amazing.
That like moment we get when she's kind of comparing rap music to, or like kind of like, I'm tired of being told what to do in rap music. Like, get your ass down on the floor, and she's like, I'll tell you to give me your coat because I'm cold. Like that.
Yeah.
She kind of encapsulates, especially like a spirit of that. I don't know. Like she's got this awkward energy throughout the film. And I think her and Ira's story is really interesting. And what do you think to the way that kind of that story is handled and how that plays out.
Yeah, I think that story is interesting, and I also like that it doesn't take over the film mm-hmm. in a way that romantic subplots often do. I love a rom-com, romantic drama, and all of it. Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong, but like in films like this, which are kind of framed as a very different kind of story, which are just with different characters, it often irritates me when you can see from the start that someone is being set up to be a love interest. I mean, and it's always a straight relationship as well.
Yeah.
That's set up from the start. And then, like, by the end of the film, you've just given up on every other plot line. And it's just the two of them getting together. And this film, like, you have the resolution that you want in that way, but I don't think that the stakes change at all. Like, yeah. Her character doesn't become more important or less important. I think she's very funny. Like, yeah. she's always so funny in a very, very sharp and, like, quite bitter way. I think also because in this film she's one of the few female comedians, mm-hmm. You can really tell.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, I think a lot of the jokes that the guys are telling are about, like, having sex with girls and stuff, and, like, yeah. you know, sure, but that's why I think when she's setting her stuff, you suddenly realize, like, how refreshing and different it is, like, just within yeah. the context of the film. Yeah.
What's funny is that in the extended cut, I kind of watched them, like, one of them last night and then the extended cut today, is Sarah Silverman is also at that gig they play at the Orpheum, and she kind of
yeah,
and she has, like, that kind of great, like, yeah, that great, like, Barack Obama joke, and it turns out to be, like, Kanye West, and it's like, oh, like, so the theatrical one, they just, like, they were like, oh, we've got to save some time. Like, instead of, like, let's cut out a few more dick jokes, we'll cut a woman out of the film, basically.
Oh, my God. Okay, right. So I didn't watch the extended cut then because I didn't see that joke in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so weird. Like, there's so many, like, Ira makes so many different jokes about, like, pull-out beds and not yeah. having sex. And you'd cut out Sarah Silverman's one.
Yeah.
What? That's so weird. Yeah, not great.
Back to the kind of, yeah, the Daisy and Ira, like, subplot. I think, like, what's really interesting about this film is that she isn't, like, a manic pixie dream girl. And the fact mm-hmm. that, like, when he confronts her, look, and he's totally in the wrong, this kind of, like, he's all up in his feelings about, like, her sleeping. Yeah, that kind of, that male entitlement over, like, somebody who you fancy, which we kind of...
We,
like,
had a conversation. You should have known you were promised to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of like, that is, like, the basis for, like, a lot of films. And we're kind of supposed to, like, there are films that we're supposed to basically back a guy who, like, that is his, like, thing of, like, oh, but no one will sleep with me, do you know what I mean? But I'm a nice guy. And, like, the way this film handles it and, like, her rebuttal to him is, like, hey, I'm young, I'm single, I can fuck whoever I want, like, and I can do whatever I want. And, like, that, it wraps it up, like, quite, I think within 20 minutes you have that confrontation, and then you get to, like, Thanksgiving, and they kind of, like, make up. But it doesn't, it kind of leaves the film kind of open-ended of, like, it doesn't have to be about them two getting together in any romantic way or anything like that. It's kind of like, but all we know and all we care is, like, oh, they could just be, like, friends who see each other at the comedy club or, like, hang out from time to time. And it's like, I'm so glad it didn't go down that avenue of, like, being like...
But... but what I like, because it's left open... No, but I like that they could. And that, crucially, if they do, that doesn't have to be, like, the end of them as a thing. And yes. I think it leans into more, like, just transparent and flexible
yeah.
relationships and that kind of thing, which I think, again, like, in a film like this is quite rare to have that conversation that you're saying between them, like her plainly laying out where she is and what she wants and what she's done and what she's doing.
Yeah, yeah. And shutting down that bullshit, right? Shutting down that kind of, like, who the fuck do you think you are? Like, I'm not betrothed to you because, like, you've been making eyes from me from across the street, you creep. Like,
so funny. I think it's great.
Two seconds. Oh, bloody hell. I've lost my notes. I will definitely edit this bit out. One of the things I wanted to talk about is how this film has aged. And I'm not just talking about kind of the prevalence of MySpace and the kind of old school YouTube layout. Do you think this film has aged particularly well, or is it kind of, I don't know, best to look upon with 2009 eyes?
I would have been interested to see it more than a few years ago, because I think, like, I watched this with 2020 and 2021 eyes. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's aged well, but I don't really know what I mean by that, because I didn't see the first time around. But I think I feel like I went into it with very much a preconceived idea of all of these people.
Yes.
And I don't know if that made me more forgiving. But then I don't think there's much to be forgiving of. Like, I don't think...
What
I think is good.
What is quite good is the people who have turned out to be problematic who are in this film play very unlikable characters.
Yeah, like, they're not in it much.
We're looking
anyway.
At you, Aziz. Yeah. Like, he plays basically like most people's idea of like the worst comedian imaginable, like this. Like, so
yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I definitely think it has like this, I don't know, has a feeling of, I think it's aged particularly, like, particularly well in the fact that,
yeah,
I think I would have seen this when it came out on DVD, and I remember the first time I saw it kind of like being like, I would have been like a teenage boy. So I was kind of expecting like more of the kind of, especially after what this came off the back of 40-year-old Virgin and Knocked Up.
Mm. Yeah, it's very different.
It's a very grown up film and tackles like some kind of complex issues and like stuff that now I'm 30 and my circumstances have changed a lot. It's kind of like, wow, like, you look at it and go like, poor, yeah, mortality is pretty like horrible. I'm making that sound like I'm really old, but like, do you know what I mean? At 15, I'm going to live forever.
No, completely.
So yeah, are there any scenes that you feel like we should like, that you'd like to talk about with this one?
I mean, I think I would, I think it's the one between Jason Schwartzman and Ira, like when Daisy is at their flat and kind of Ira walks in on it and realizes that Jason Schwartzman has just had sex with her, and the fact that Jason Schwartzman just had he just has this kind of apologetic look in his eyes.
Puppy dog, yeah.
Not like not being sorry for the situation, not being sorry that Ira's found out, as if he is disappointed in Ira as a friend that Ira did not do what was necessary to avoid this situation.
Yeah.
Like, he is sorry that his friend failed, basically, rather than being sorry that he has, like, you know, upset his friend or done the wrong thing or whatever. It's just so funny. And like, and I can't remember if it's in that scene or one later. I think it may be slightly later, but then he says, and again, it's just being like, it's not my fault, it's completely yours. He goes, if I didn't sleep with every girl you wanted to sleep with, I wouldn't sleep with anybody. Yeah. And then Jonah Hill is like, it's true, he wouldn't. And I'm just like, how are we all in agreement that this is like an okay conversation to be having? Which again turns it into poor Jason Schwartzman, which I just think it's just such an elaborate bit that they keep going for so long, and you expect someone to break it at some point and they never do. It's so funny.
I think that is like the kind of magic of a Judd Apatow film. I know he's known to kind of like just leave the camera going, like if you got bits to throw in, and like, yeah, some people love it. Like in this instance, it works really well. Other people are like, that's what I hate about these films. Do you know what I mean? It's like, trim this up. Mm. A personal favorite moment of mine involving Jason Schwartzman is this. I've just got to play it because I don't think I can deliver this story anywhere near as good as he can.
When I was younger, my grandfather died, and we were all gathered around him, and there was this one candle next to his bed, and right after he died, the candle started flickering, and then it just went out. What? Yeah, and we looked around, and there were no windows. Like, nothing in that room. And sounds crazy, but we all thought it was him going to heaven, you know?
You don't pass through fire to get to heaven. I think he went to hell.
What'd you just say?
I think your grandfather probably went to hell.
Don't do that.
Are you kidding me right now?
I'm not. I'm sorry.
You're going to make fun of me right now just after I opened up to you guys like that?
It's not my fault your grandfather's in hell. It's not a big deal. Some grandpas go to hell. Oh,
come on. Don't be a jerk to me just because I make more money than you guys.
How much do you make again?
You guys are just projecting all your hatred onto me. Good.
Okay, and don't be super bummed out because your grandfather's playing backgammon with Hitler right now.
So yeah, for a film that is packed full of like great comedy talent, I think Jason Schwartzman makes a real case for stealing the show on this one. Like, kind of like he really does well with what he's given. Like, he kind of
He's not trying to be funny.
Yeah.
Like, his character's not, he's fully believes everything. He is completely convinced that he is hard done by, more talented and more attractive and more successful than everyone. And for that reason, we must all pity him. It's amazing.
I guess he, like, got to do some level of really getting into character, because you can find them on YouTube. There is, like, I say four, like, 6-minute episodes of Yo Teach. So, like, they filmed the whole episode. And there's even like an EPK like video of him in character, kind of like talking about what the show is and just being like this kind of like, oh yes, it's really good. I'm really good. Like, just an absolute piece of shit, basically. So like that, like, so like, I feel like he got the opportunity to kind of not just like in his own time do stuff that is like character development. He kind of got to do it on screen. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of filmed. So yeah, let's talk about
Wow.
So what do you make of Yo Teach? Do you, if it was airing, would you watch it?
Would I watch it? I mean, I love Bo Burnham, so I would. I wouldn't be happy about it. You know, I would reluctantly sit through it. It's just so, like, it's, again, it's just such a commitment to a very strange joke that, yes, like, is not funny. Like, Yo Teach is not funny. I wouldn't watch it. I don't understand how Jason Schwartzman is getting, like, his character is getting paid on this thing. Like, where is their money coming from? Who is watching this? Yeah, no, absolutely not. No way.
So it feels like, yeah, like we mentioned Bo Burnham, like he kind of like seems to be the one who gets like the biggest speaking part from the Yo Teach cast. Like,
yeah, I mean, he has a line at Thanksgiving when George Simmons comes in and everyone's freaking out a bit, and Bo Burnham's just like, I'm a comedian. And George Simmons is just like, great, yes, good for you. Oh, I love it. Very funny.
There are some fantastic cameos in this as well, and I think one that really stands out to me is the kind of like double header of Eminem and Ray Romano, like that kind of like
amazing
that scene they have, like, and yeah, just all of them, like, even if it's like that kind of round table you get with George seeing some of his old friends, and you get some, like, I guess, yeah, for people, big comedy nerds. Like, I only knew Paul Reiser because I think he was on like Mad About You or something like that. But like, from watching like behind the scenes or whatever, they're all like old school comedy names and stuff like that. And it's beautiful. So Before we start to wrap up talking about the film, I guess we'd be remiss not to talk about the fantastic Leslie Mann.
No, nothing's going on around here.
Leslie Mann is absolutely fantastic in this. What do you make of Leslie Mann in general? And do you like her in Funny People?
Yeah, I really like her. I think the first thing I had seen Leslie Mann in was 17 again, opposite Zac Efron. Mm-hmm. And I love that film. completely sincere, like, you know, this is for another podcast, but I sincerely love that film. I think she's fantastic. You know, I think there could have easily been a bit of an eye roll of like, oh, it's a Judd Apatow film, so obviously Leslie Mann's in it. But I'm sorry, like, he fell in love with her for a reason. Like, she's absolutely fucking amazing. I think she's so good in this film. Just very, like, very empathetic, very loving, but not, like, not cloying in any way. Mm-hmm. Just, I don't know. She just strikes, she's so warm.
Yeah.
And I could just watch her forever. Like, I think she's so good. She's amazing in this.
I think that's that storyline, like in the latter half of this film. When I first saw it, I was kind of, as I said, I was, what was this film, 12 years old? So I would have been like, yeah, my late teens, 18 or whatever. I think like that, I was a bit like, oh, that was like, why is it going a bit like this? Because I was an idiot. But like watching it now, I like absolutely love that stuff, that kind of like, I don't know, even the peanut butter game, I'm like, this is so sweet. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely. And to see Eric Banner as well, who's kind of got this career of being like a kind of stoic man, like kind of get to turn his hand at comedy and stuff like that is great. And I Leslie Mann, I think, yeah, as you said, like, I know Judd Apatow has said, like, she doesn't know she's funny, which I think is hard to believe because, like, she is absolutely killer in, like, everything. I think back to, like, Knocked Up, and there's that scene, like, when she's just calling a doorman for, like, a minute, and it's like, she's fucking hilarious. And she's kind of got that, like, unintentionally, like, funny voice, like, that's kind of, yeah. She's great. But what do you make of that kind of, that, I don't know, like, part two of the film and kind of how it kind of resolves in the fact that George goes there to get back the love of his life, and ultimately she realizes he isn't the man that, like, she thinks she wants, and despite his flaws and cheating, she kind of does want to stay with her husband.
Yeah, I it's really interesting. I think I actually forgot that they didn't end up together. Like, I watched it last year and then watched it again today, and I was like, oh, they don't end up together. That's weird. Different movie. No, I think it's really interesting. I think that you really believe, like, when everything's going well between them, you really believe it. Mm-hmm. And you believe, like they're meant to be, and the years in between have just been a waste of time, I suppose. And I think, yeah, it takes a lot of skill to be able to then turn around that kind of very credible affection between the two of them into also within the space of essentially an hour, because he's only got an hour on screen. Yeah. Within an hour, like, turning it around to make you realize why actually they have grown up and grown apart, and like it doesn't change the love they had those years ago, and even, you know, on that day that they spent together, but that they're fundamentally different people now. Yeah. And just to encapsulate all of that is amazing. I think it's just the very, very rich performances.
It's weird, but like, I kind of relate to that, like, that the thing that Laura gets held up on, and the fact that, like, he doesn't cry at the, like, her daughter singing Memories from Cats, even though I don't like Cats, I don't like Memories, I think it's a terrible song, but again, that's for another podcast. But like, yeah, as like I have a son, and like I'm a single parent, and like I always think of that thing of being like, I don't know, like that accept, like I think she realizes in that moment that like unwillingness to basically accept her children, and like I think it's portrayed really well, because it is that thing of like, I don't know, I often have like anxiety about the thing of like, even when I'm talking to friends, like comes up in conversation about my kid, and then it's like a tirade of, he did this, he did that, like let me show you this picture of him wearing sunglasses and he's really funny, and like there is that thing that you can get a bit butt hurt when something that you love so much, like, and then people just go like, yeah, cool, like yeah he's really, and like I guess like amplify that feeling to how it must feel when you think you love someone and they like love you wholly, and then they react kind of like not in the way that, like, not even the way that you want, but like somebody who, I don't know, I think in like that unconditional love, in that thing, you would love the kids as much as like the person you love.
It makes you realize there are conditions, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, that was a bit of a weird tirade to about black kid. this film totally wraps up in a kind of sweet way, in that they go back to normal life after this excursion to the suburbs, and George and Ira manage to become friends again when George returns the favor by writing Ira some jokes. Like, do you think this film wraps up in a nice, neat way, Ella?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice. I think it very much follows the logic of the other stories in terms of, I suppose, finding balance in the relationship. Like, it makes you realize that neither George nor Ira fully has complete power over the other, which I think we saw in the relationship between Ira and Daisy, and between George and Laura, and all of that. And I think it's really nice that, you know, they seemingly, it's seemingly a happy end, but also you can see that it is unfinished, because particularly in the way that the credits literally just roll up on like the table where they're, like during Ira's lunch break at the deli where he works, the fact that the credits kind of roll up over that, I really like that, because it makes you think, oh, they're going to carry on doing what they're doing, and like eventually Ira probably will find George annoying, and like George will just like fuck up some other relationship, but like, you know, it's fine, we can come back to this scene, and in a couple of weeks maybe they'll be at this table writing jokes again. And I like that. I think it wraps it up really nicely.
It's the fact it like kind of ends on ellipsis, that like we've just been privy to like a moment in some people's lives, as opposed to like this is a definitive story of like, I don't know, it's kind of like, you feel like a fly on the wall of like some goings on. Before we wrap it up, I must ask you what you think of Jason Schwartzman's music he has on the score for this. So he has a couple of tracks that are, under the name Coconut College. It's Coconut something. 1 second, guys, I'll get it for you. Jason Schwartzman, he's credited as like one of two composers on this, Coconut Records, and like he's got this you'd pretty recognize it. I think it's over like DVD menus and stuff like that, people I'm listening, but so are you aware of Jason Schwartzman being a musician and the kind of like music that he puts out, Twella?
I loosely was aware of it. Clearly not to the full extent, because the Phantom Planet trivia has blown my mind. I mean, I think his music's fine. Yeah. I know that sounds like a negative thing, but it's not. I often think in films like this, by which I mean Judd Apatow comedies / very starry I don't know, just like very starry, romantic, like comedy dramas in Hollywood. Like I'm thinking of, I watched Sleeping with Other People the other week with Jason Sudeikis and Alison Brie, which is, oh, it's so good. But just like in films like that, where it's very much about the actors, I don't really tend to notice the music or even just like the cinematography or just much technical stuff. I don't know if that's just me. My brain just kind of melts when I have like too many actors to look at who I really like. But yeah, I can't say the music made much of an impact on me today at all.
Well, I think it's that thing like music in comedies anyway, like kind of very much seems like an afterthought. And like this weirdly does have like, it has like tons of needle drops that I think like definitely do the job of a score. Do you know what I mean? It's like, as like that kind of Warren Zevon track when he's making him the playlist and like gets George choked up, or it has like George even like playing music, or as we mentioned, it has memories from Cats, and it kind of like has all these like big, like, yeah, I think James Taylor who performs in the, like, do you know what I mean? It very much feels like your dad's record collection, but like every song is playing its part. Amazing. So as I like to wrap up these, I always like to see if you managed, and I've got a couple if you didn't, find any Coppola connections within this film, people who are either in it or worked on it, who pop up in other films that happen to have another Coppola family member in them. Did you manage to find any, Ella?
Oh God, I don't think I did.
Don't worry. I've got a few. So Adam Sandler is in Little Nicky with Patricia Arquette, who at the time was married to Nicolas Cage, and is also in Airheads, which Jason Schwartzman's older brother, John Schwartzman, is the cinematographer. Aubrey Plaza is in Scott Pilgrim versus the World with Jason Schwartzman again, and is in A Glimpse in the Mind of Charles Swan III, which is directed by Sofia Coppola's brother, Roman. And then let's close it out. Leslie Mann is in The Bling Ring and The Croods 2.
Oh, yeah.
Opens, yeah.
All right.
July 16th.
Cool.
Yeah. So as I like to score these films, Ella, I always ask, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
it would definitely be a red. I think. I mean, I vaguely know, but I don't really know loads about wine. it wouldn't be anything too intense. I'll tell you, it wouldn't be anything too intense. It's because it has to be smooth enough for you to like keep drinking it throughout 2.5 hours.
Yes.
So it has to be like mellow and kind of warm and not too spicy, not too fruity, just very kind of solid, smooth, so that you could keep drinking it and not get distracted by the wine throughout the 2.5 hour runtime.
Perfect. Yeah. And would you rate this as a bottom shelf, mid shelf or top shelf wine, aka is the film good or bad?
I would honestly say top shelf.
Top shelf, yeah.
I'd say top shelf because...
to get that wine.
Huh?
You're getting on your tiptoes to get that wine.
I would, because, you know, I'm not saying it's top of the top shelf.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There are many things on the top shelf. It is one among many things which are top shelf,
perfect,
I would say.
And, yeah, what I like to do is just so we can kind of, I don't know, well, I these questions, I'm so glad I'm on this end of it as opposed to answering them. The first one is, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies of the entire rest of the family?
Jesus Christ.
You can be totally selfish as well. You can be totally selfish. It doesn't have to be like, this person did this for similar history. Like,
I mean, I think... I have to follow my gut on this one because otherwise this would be torture. I have to keep Sofia Coppola and get rid of everyone else. I'm really sorry to everyone else. No. But, you know, teenage girl forever.
She's got this perfect, like, I don't know, was it six film filmography that kind of like every film has something to offer. Do you know what I mean? Like they're
I need them all. Yeah.
Amazing. So are they the greatest film family of all time?
Oh. Like probably. I don't know. Again, I have to go with my gut. I can't think of anyone else.
It's an impossible question because there's so many of them.
Yeah. I think like they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think I mean look, I'm trying to think if I lived in a world without the Coppola family in film, that would be terrible. Like I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So I think they must be the greatest, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've talked about it a lot on this that like they have like weird ripple effects on other filmmakers, like even as far back as like George Lucas. It was Francis Ford Coppola who kind of took him under his wing. And then Spike Jones, like it was Francis Ford Coppola again who gave him the script for being John Malkovich because he was
insane.
He was at the time he was dating or married to Sophia, so it was like that thing of. And then you think like if he didn't have that great breakout film, would he still just be making Jackass and skate videos? Like not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
Like and that there's all these kind of I don't know. How you look at it, it's like Patricia Arquette wins an Oscar after being married to Nicolas Cage. Not saying that there's any correlation there, but like, there's all these kind of like tendrils that go on. And possibly the most important question of this podcast is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Hang on, give me a second. Give me a second. He says, I fucked up my karaoke choice. I meant to sing This Would Be the Place.
Perfect.
This Must Be the Place. Fuck. Oh, I fucked up my one-liner. Shit. God. Well, anyway, he says that. He talks about karaoke.
Amazing. Yeah.
What does he say? What do you think he says?
I'm keeping tight-lipped on this because I feel like it has to be like a grand reveal for like the end
do you
of
know?
The podcast. No, I don't know. It's all totally open to interpretation.
Oh, okay, fine.
Okay.
No, we'll wait. It's fine. I'll tune in. No problem.
Yes, it's a way to get so the final episode of the podcast, every other previous guest will tune in. It's a way to spike the numbers. So I'm playing the real long game here.
Smart.
Yeah, I've got like 250 films to go through before I get there. But
oh my God. I rate it. No, fair play.
Thank you. That would be the excellent, the ultimate karaoke choice. I think that's my go-to Talking Heads. This Must Be the Places. Yeah, absolutely perfect. Again, Ella, where can people find you if they want to kind of hound you on some of your answers on this or kind of give us some stick at... we've mentioned anything or didn't mention anything about the film or they disagree with us?
Oh God, the pressure now. You can find me on Twitter. I am @Ella_Kemp. And you can follow me on Letterboxd. My name is Ella Kemp. Please be kind to me. I'm only small.
Don't worry. I will take the brunt of all of the negativity if people disagree with anything we've said on this episode.
Probably not. I'll be dumb.
Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you for having me.
So there we go, another connection made, another film down, and another vote for the Coppolas being the greatest film family of all time. As me and Ella discussed there in the outro, if you have any differing opinions about this film, get in touch with me, leave Ella well alone. And you can do so via all the social media, so that's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd, all @CagedInPod, or you can drop me an email, cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week on the podcast, I am joined by one of my favorite podcasters from one of my favorite podcasts, and that is Daryl Bear from the fantastic, the sublime, one of the best to ever do it, the triple bill titled podcast, absolute wizard. That is Daryl Bear from Southern Double Deep. So I do hope that you will join both of us then to discuss Taking of the Pelham 1-2-3, which is scored by David Shire. For any US listeners, if you haven't had the chance already to watch Michael Sarnowski's Pig, do be sure to go see it in the theatres, or as of today, you'll be able to catch it digitally. So download it, rent it, enjoy it. It is a fantastic Nicolas Cage performance. All the reviews are right. It's beautiful. It's kind of transcendent. It's emotional. It's wonderful. And if you've enjoyed the film, do head back and listen to my episodes with Brett W. Buckman, the editor of the film, who also edited Mandy and Color Out of Space, as well as the actor David Nell, who has this perfect, beautiful scene alongside Nicolas Cage and Alex Wolff, that when you've seen the film, you will know the scene I'm talking about exactly. Those listeners in the UK who managed to get tickets to Fright Fest this year, there is the European premiere of both Prisoners of the Ghostland, starring the one, the only Nicolas Cage. And friends of the podcast, Spectrevision, have their new film, No Man of God, starring Elijah Wood. It's a Ted Bundy film. I'm going to be watching both of those films at Fright Fest, so if you're there, come find me. Say hello. For Prisoners of the Ghostland, I will be hanging about outside afterwards to get some first reaction interviews from people. So yeah, it'll be great to see some of you, and I very much look forward to meeting you. So if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this right now. This has been Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and me, Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. So remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.